following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, and welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I am Gavin Graham. And as always on Wednesday mornings at this time, I'm here with several experts to talk about what's going on in these markets and to help you understand them and find out what's really happening. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money. And I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that are, shall we say, a little less promising. I'm here each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Today I'm going to look at some of the reasons why we expect emerging markets to have a better year this year than last and why frontier market funds are taking off. I'll also check out some of the differences between smaller frontier market funds and the larger ones. Then we'll go on to look at some investment prospects in the Far East. Then off to Nigeria, talk to African correspondent Samuel Akudja about the activities of some very well-known developed market companies over there. And then we'll wrap up the program with a look at Pakistan in light of the recent election results there. We always figure we're getting the program off on the right foot when we start with Jim Howard, a long-time Wall Street veteran and chairman of Plimsollmar Capital, a division of Zephyr Management LP in New York. The two companies have about $750 million in assets under management. Good morning, Jim, and thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
In emerging markets, a number of analysts are suggesting that emerging markets will have a better year this year than last year, which wouldn't be difficult, to be fair, given that they were pretty disappointing last year. Would you agree with that? And why do you feel that they'd have a better year?
Yeah, we're moving in that direction. The exact timing, of course, is difficult because the developed markets have so much momentum. But if you look at relative valuations, U.S. markets particularly have gone slightly above their long-term average, and if they keep going, will at some point become overvalued, whereas emerging markets are selling at about 8 times earnings, which relative to developed markets and absolutely is very much on the lower end of their valuation range. And in addition, if the U.S. and the developed markets continue to do a little bit better in terms of growth, that will pull up demand for some of the exports from emerging markets, coincident with the internal demand in emerging markets that has continued to grow. So the earnings growth in the emerging markets should accelerate. So you have very attractive valuations and the possibility of accelerating earnings momentum in the emerging markets.
That's obviously a pretty good reason for looking at emerging markets now. Why exactly did they underperform so much last year, given that the developed markets were doing relatively well and that presumably that was reflecting a more optimistic outlook about economic growth?
Right. Well, you did have good economic growth, reasonable economic growth in the United States, but the rest of the world was subdued. China came in a little lower than expected. India came in a little lower than expected. Europe is what it is. Some of the geographies in Latin America, such as Brazil, came in lower than expected. And so worldwide growth was somewhat less than many expected. And, of course, that led to poor performance for the price of commodities, which dominates certain emerging market geographies and certain emerging market stock markets. Internal demand in the emerging markets remained strong, and if you bought the stocks of companies that cater to the rising middle class in emerging markets, you did better than emerging markets in general. But what you have to say is that worldwide growth was about 1% lower than it needed to be to create an attractive export environment for the emerging market commodities.
Now, I know one of the, you mentioned China and India maybe growing a little less rapidly than anticipated. Obviously, one of the major fears has been that China is actually going to experience a crash at some stage because the growth that they've been having is unsustainable and has been propped up by substantial government intervention and funding. How reasonable do you feel the fears of the China bears are? Some of them can be a little intemperate in expressing it, but it's undoubtedly a genuine concern for a lot of people.
Well, you can't ignore it. There are some very smart people who adhere to that line of thinking. The critical issue is their ability to switch from export and investment to consumption. Which is something that is in fact happening gradually but consistently, and they also need that switch internally, that you have to have a better life for the people to tolerate the communist political system. So far, the Chinese have a pretty good record of managing this process, and all the evidence is that they will continue to be able to do so, but it would be foolish not to keep your eye on the risk that the bears point out.
And obviously China and indeed India, two of the four BRIC economies, Brazil, Russia, India and China, which has become a very fashionable concept. Do you feel there's much validity in that? We're looking at it just as a fairly sort of untrained observer, as it were. It would seem these are four very different economies and would have different drivers.
Yeah, I would say that the term BRIC is an obsolete term at this point. You know, Russia is not a high growth economy, and each of the others have different dynamics. I think the proper phrase is emerging markets, non-China emerging markets, and then of course some of the larger frontier markets, which are growing and maturing and becoming graduating from frontier to emerging countries like Indonesia, the Philippines, etc. So I wouldn't use the BRIC term anymore. I would use emerging markets, non-China emerging markets, frontier markets, and graduating frontier markets.
Yeah. I think that's a fair distinction, Jim, and we're going to be looking at some of the non-China Asia countries later in the program with another contributor. But for China itself, you, I believe, would feel that markets like Hong Kong and Singapore might be the better way to gain access to the growth within the China economy simply because of better corporate governance. As I mentioned, we are going to be looking at some of the non-China Asia countries later, but would you feel that maybe Singapore and Hong Kong might be a better way to access growth in the Chinese economy?
Yeah, I think the way to play China is through the markets in Hong Kong and Singapore that capture the growth and all of the geographies in Asia that benefit from the growth being generated by China and the internal growth that's being generated there as a result.
So perhaps one could say that you made a definition, a difference between the non-China Asia markets and the frontier markets and the other emerging markets. Would it be fair to say that people who've had some investment success with emerging markets might feel a little more comfortable about starting to get exposure to frontier markets because they've
the growth is migrating to, the relative growth and the flows of capital. But having said that, execution is very important. You don't want to do it yourself. You want to invest in regional funds or country-specific funds with managers that have experience and good research capability. But yes, I think that the future will be in some of these emerging geographies that are being brought along by the wave of growth in non-China Asia.
And just trying to look into the crystal ball, which is always, I know, a question that fund managers hate, and I always did when I was running money myself, but given we've had a somewhat better start to the year so far for emerging markets, that some of the growth in the developed markets we've seen, or at least in their stock markets, seems to now be flowing through into flows into emerging market funds. Do you feel that that's sustainable? And do you, what would you think, given we're only 6 weeks away from the halfway point of 2013, what would you expect for the rest of the year as far as emerging markets are concerned?
Right. Well, in the absence of an accident in the financial markets or in credit markets someplace, I think the relative performance in emerging markets should outpace that in the U.S. for the rest of the year, only because the U.S. has come so far so fast. So as long as the world that we see today continues, I would think that the relative valuation and relative profit performance looks better in the emerging markets, and that if the U.S. market has another 3 or 4 or 5% in it, that the emerging markets hopefully could do twice that between now and the end of the year.
And of course, Jim, as we discussed at the beginning of the interview, the valuations for emerging markets are now pretty low. You were mentioning, I think, about 8 times. That is that 2013's forecast earnings?
Yes, that's for 2013. And that's, you know,
and
it's an
is that also
number, so yeah, there's a lot of noise around it, but if you just take an aggregate, and the point there is the relative valuation developed versus emerging, in addition to the absolute difference that the multiple in the U.S. is about twice that, in spite of the fact that the long-term secular growth in the emerging markets is higher.
Right. So, in fact, you've got the opportunity to buy superior growth at a cheaper valuation, which is what you'd always look for as a successful investor.
Yes, especially if you're willing to look at it on a multi-year basis.
And just to finish up, Jim, for frontier markets specifically, the valuation is around the same, or is it a little higher?
It's a little higher at this point, but again, you have to drill down country by country rather than take an average. It gets very important when you get to the frontiers to differentiate each and every geography.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks very much indeed. Appreciate your being back with us, and we hope to speak to you again very soon.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Our thanks to James Awad at Plimsoll Capital in New York. This is shaping up, if what Jim is saying is correct, and certainly I think a number of analysts would agree that that's the case, to be a good year for both emerging markets and frontier markets. We just heard Jim talking about emerging markets. When I come back from the break, I'll be talking to Pradita Chakraborty at Harding Loevner and get his reasons for believing that frontier markets will perform just as well, in fact, maybe even more strongly than the established emerging markets. When we come back for the break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Good morning and welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In the last segment, I was talking to emerging market veteran James Awad about the resurgence in emerging market funds performance this year, which had something of a underperforming year last year. Now for a look at some of the reasons why frontier market funds might also have a successful year, I have Pradeep Chakraborty on the line from Harding Loevner in New Jersey. He's co-lead manager for the Frontier Emerging Markets Fund there. Welcome to the program, Pradeep.
Thank you, Gavin. Thanks for having me here.
Great pleasure. Now, you're suggesting that frontier markets should eventually be as successful as the emerging markets have been over the last decade, 15 years or so. Could you briefly enumerate some of the reasons why you and Harding Loevner as a firm believe that?
Sure. You know, in many ways, if you look at frontier markets today, they're very similar to the emerging markets of 15 years back, really. One of the key similarities is the demographic profile of the frontier markets today that are similar to the emerging markets demographics, which help them rise. You know, they have large populations. If you look at countries like Bangladesh and Nigeria, with populations of 150 million and 164 million, they're really much bigger than Russia and Mexico. And they're close to three times the population of South Africa, really. You know, more importantly, these populations are youthful populations with increasing education levels, as well as increasing technology-based skill sets. And we're witnessing similar, very similar trends in rural to urban migration in the frontier markets as we've seen in the emerging markets, you know, 10 to 15 years back. And what we're seeing as a result is increasing presence of global manufacturing and service facilities to these lower cost frontier countries, you know, like especially like Bangladesh and Vietnam, which are really leading to rising income levels and strong secular demand for growth for consumer products, both staples and discretionary. The other interesting similarity is the low leverage levels in the frontier countries today, very similar to you know what it was for emerging markets, and the credit penetration has started increasing as we've seen over the years in the emerging markets. And as a result, even in frontier markets, we're seeing, you know, attractive growth opportunity for banks in the frontier markets. You know, a lot of frontier markets are also, if you look at the government, you know, they've started ramping up investment spending on infrastructure development. Again, we're not too dissimilar from what the emerging markets saw, really. You know, if you see that across countries like Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Qatar. As a result, there are, again, very good opportunities for, you know, equity investors like us in stocks of cement companies. To you know, round it up, I would say that, you know, in general, trends in, you know, deregulation, trends on globalization, as well as capital inflows into frontier countries seem to be following a very similar pattern to what the larger emerging countries have gone through in the last 10 to 15 years, really.
Well, Pradeep, that's an excellent brief summary of the reasons to be cheerful. Are there any of those emerging markets? I know you mentioned, for example, Bangladesh and Nigeria because of their large youthful populations. But amongst the frontier markets that you look at, would there be a couple that you'd feel look particularly attractive and maybe one or two that you're not so keen on at Harding Loevner?
Yes, I mean, we love Nigeria. You know, this is a country which is going through a series of structural changes. You know, the changes in the power sector, oil and gas sector, the telecom sector is going through a lot of changes. And we find, you know, Nigerian banks to be very attractive right now, the cement companies, the consumer goods companies as well. Bangladesh is the other, another, you know, country where we are very bullish about. You know, for all the reasons I mentioned above, not the least, you know, its low cost base, and large population of, you know, which is basically Bangladesh's competitive advantage. Saudi Arabia is the third one, I would say, you know, which is seeing a huge surge of, opportunities, especially on the consumer spending side. Post the Arab Spring, we've seen a series of measures taken by the Saudi Arabian government, which is boosting disposable income across Saudi residents, including jobs as well as Saudization schemes, and consumer discretionary spend has just is booming in that country. The ones we're not very bullish about would include Argentina for obvious reasons. The rising inflation as well as mismanagement of the economy is really a worry, and we don't have any investments there.
No, I think that's a view shared by a number of frontier market specialists. But you mentioned the Arab Spring when you were talking about reasons to be enthusiastic about Saudi. And obviously one of the concerns for investors in frontier markets funds is perceived higher levels of political risk. Do you feel that, for example, Gulf Cooperation Council countries and Saudi are doing sufficient in terms of addressing the concerns of the population to offset the likelihood of a repeat of the Arab Spring in those countries?
Yes, it's a very valid concern, and which is why we feel that, you know, active management, especially in the frontier world, is very important. There are countries like Egypt which are suffering through the process. Countries, we're seeing what's happening in Syria and the knock-on effect on surrounding countries. But then there are countries like Saudi Arabia, like Qatar, which have actually learned from the mistakes of their neighboring countries and have pumped in a lot of money towards resolving or rather proactively preventing any such events in their domestic economies. And that's really helping the companies that operate out there. And we see huge opportunities, especially in countries like Saudi and Qatar.
And just to perhaps look at one final aspect of the attractiveness of frontier markets, because the low correlation that they have not only with each other but also with both developed markets and, interestingly, with emerging markets, I think is felt to be a major attraction of the frontier markets asset class.
Yes, the frontier market correlation with the global indices is lower than that of emerging market with the global indices. That helps. What is more important is what you mentioned, you know, the low correlations between the different frontier markets, for example, between Nigeria and Bangladesh and Kazakhstan and Saudi or Vietnam, very low correlation, which to active managers like us, we can really provide our clients with a very well-diversified portfolio because of the low correlation between these markets.
So although the individual markets themselves, because of their developing nature, may be quite volatile themselves, because of their low correlations with each other, they actually overall end up helping reduce the overall volatility of the clients' portfolios.
Absolutely. That is the attractiveness of investing in the frontier asset class, really.
Well, that's excellent and a very good summary of both the bull case for frontier markets and also the markets that you and Harding Lubner find attractive within it. We really appreciate you taking the time to discuss your approach to these markets with us, Predictor, and we hope we might be able to come back and talk about how things are going a little later in the year.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thanks for having me here.
Appreciate that. My next guest will look at frontier markets from a slightly different perspective. I have Larry Spidell on the line from La Jolla, California. He's the founding partner and chief investment officer at Frontier Market Asset Management, LLC, out there. Before setting up Frontier Market Asset Management, he worked at companies like Nicholas Applegate, where he launched some of their emerging market funds, and with other companies he worked on China and Russia funds. He maintains that smaller frontier market funds have some advantages over larger ones, and I'm going to ask him to explain that. Welcome to the program, Larry.
It's a pleasure, Gavin. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, and very good to have you back. Before I get to the advantages of maybe smaller size over larger in an asset class like frontier markets, I understand in terms of what vehicles you have available for investors, you have two pool funds. Which sort of clients would those be for?
Well, our funds are LPs, limited partnerships for wealthy individuals, so one has to be an accredited investor. It's not the mutual fund format, but we think it is user-friendly for investors that have adequate resources to diversify and therefore can include Frontier among their other core holdings.
Absolutely. Now, we were talking about frontier market funds and the fact that perhaps smaller funds are maybe at something of an advantage comparing to larger funds. What are the reasons for that might be the case?
Well, let me start by saying that the major opportunity, I believe, in frontier markets is to capture this rising tide of a rising middle class, which is accompanied by very inefficiently priced local stock mm-hmm. exchanges.
Right.
And so when you're working in the frontier, you have an opportunity to identify less discovered stocks which are priced more by local retail investors than they are by global institutional investors. And hopefully those less discovered stocks won't remain undiscovered for long. But it's this inefficiency which provides the real driving force for active management. And it's one of the challenges that investors have seen in the large liquid markets such as the United States or the EAFE countries. So with that in mind, you know, a smaller fund has the ability to dig deeper and find some of those opportunistic, mispriced securities.
And then, of course, Larry, also to actually get a position that's sufficiently large to have a meaningful impact on the performance of the fund that's buying these underpriced stocks.
Well, yes. I mean, this is absolutely true. The trading volumes in frontier countries are quite small, and in fact, the market sizes are quite small. When you when you look at frontier countries overall, you know, if you start with world market cap, let's say, of $45 trillion, using data from the World Bank, which is a year or so old. $45 trillion, and then you dig down and you look at that, the U.S. is probably a third of that, EAFE is another third, emerging markets are about $11 trillion, frontier markets are just over $1 trillion, and if you take out the GCC countries, the rich oil producers, you're left with around $500 million. So, you know, a $500 million opportunity space, heck, that's the size of a single $500 billion, rather. You know, that's the size of Mexico by itself.
Yep.
A little bit bigger than Mexico, a little smaller than Russia. So this is a small space. It's not for the big boys, I believe.
And when you're looking at frontier market investors investing for clients, do you find that the high net worth or the institutional tend to be more open to the concept of investing? And within institutional, are there any differences, say, between pension plans and endowments?
Well, it's difficult to say across, you know, a broad spectrum, but, you know, we do find that wealthy individuals are often people who have traveled to the frontier countries. And this is a question for all of us to ask ourselves. Have you been in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa? Have you been in Vietnam? These are wonderful places to go to. And if you do go, it heightens your awareness of the opportunity to invest, because you can see beyond the headlines that these are good places with good people, hardworking people, and exciting places. So just to answer your question, yes, the high net worth individuals, and also we're finding foundations and endowments are more open to it than some of the other institutions.
That's very interesting, Larry. And just to finish up, you mentioned, given that these are inefficiently priced markets that are relatively illiquid, I presume, therefore, that you'd be a believer in active management being better than passive management, especially with, as you mentioned, also the very high weight of the oil-rich Gulf Cooperation Council countries within the Frontier Markets Index.
Well, yes, and there are two parts to that, because, you know, the theme that I was emphasizing early on was the rising middle class, and you really don't have that in the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. You also have stock markets in those countries that are much more efficiently priced and economies that are much more competitive. So I think the real opportunity here is in the smaller, less discovered markets in Southern Asia, like Bangladesh, Vietnam, Central Asia, like Kazakhstan, Eastern Europe, and in all these markets, as well as our favorite, which is Sub-Saharan Africa, being almost half our portfolios, we think there are real rich opportunities to dig deep and learn new information about companies and to profit from it. That's what active management is all about.
Excellent, Larry. thanks very much indeed. Do appreciate you coming back to talk to us about your approach at Frontier Market Asset Management to investing in frontier markets. Hope to be speaking to you again in the near future.
Thank you, Gavin. My pleasure.
When I come back from the break, I'll be talking to Paul DeSisto in New York about some of the countries that may get overlooked amongst emerging and frontier markets due to the emphasis on the BRICS and the better-known investment destinations.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750. You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. I'm going back to New York now for a look at some countries investors may overlook due to the focus on BRIC markets. I have Paul DeSisto online. He's Director and Senior Portfolio Manager at M&R Capital Management, Inc., which has about $500 million in assets under management, mostly for individuals, charities, and trusts. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome. Thank you, Gavin, for having me on.
Delighted to have you here. I mean, BRICS is, of course, the very well-known acronym for which we should thank Jim O'Neill, retiring head of asset management at Goldman Sachs. Recently, there's another term that has been appearing on some of the news services called TIMS, which I understand stands for Turkey, Indonesia, Mexico, and the Philippines. Are the TIMS a group to which we should be paying attention?
I certainly think so, not only as a group, but individually as well, and I think one should be careful as to which of the TIMS they're going to consider. Of course, it includes far more than the four mentioned. That's just an acronym to try to get one's hand around all the so-called overlooked or frontier markets, which you've been discussing so far this morning. So they also include places like Thailand and some of the Middle Eastern countries as well.
So obviously the attractions are for the frontier markets or the next generation of frontier and emerging markets, that they're going to repeat the process that has seen the emerging markets themselves be so successful. Are there some countries which you feel could follow in the footsteps of places like South Korea and Taiwan?
There are, and I would like to concentrate a bit on East Asia and Southeast Asia. I'm particularly interested in the Philippines, which is seeing a lot of inflow from Western banks creating headquarters there, building headquarters there as they try to flee some of the high costs in Hong Kong and Singapore. I also like Indonesia with a rapidly growing population, Thailand as well, for the same reason, and Malaysia. These companies, countries as a group tend to have a very strong work ethic going back hundreds of years. And I think that they're going to be the next wave of Asian countries that start to grow very, very rapidly. They do have the advantage of growing populations, which are youthful populations as well. They tend to have very low government debt relative to GDP, more like in the neighborhood of 40 to 55% as opposed to some of the developed markets. For example, here in the United States, we have 78% debt to GDP. Japan, 220%. Now, I understand that's a unique case because they owe it to themselves, but in Italy at 120%. So because of these systems and the situations, because the countries tend to be underbanked, there's a lot of room for development there.
So specifically within some of those Southeast Asian countries you mentioned, are there some individual stocks that you like and perhaps just a couple and maybe ones that you have in your portfolios, if that's not giving away trade secrets, as it were?
No, not at all. This is not actually one of those four countries, but it has a lot of business in those four countries. It's a Singapore country called United Overseas Bank. I've owned this for a number of years. It does have subsidiaries in all of the countries that I mentioned, however. So because, as I mentioned, a lot of these countries are underbanked, there's opportunities for foreign banks. So United Overseas Bank, and the symbol is UOVEY, at around $35 a share, yields almost 3%. And it looks just like it's going to continue growing. It's been growing along quite steadily over the past several years, and as it should participate in the growth of these countries. Another one I like, which is out of Thailand, is Advanced Information Systems. I've owned this one for a number of years. This is a mobile phone service in Thailand. It has quadrupled in the past 4 or 5 years as mobile phone usage continues to grow, and as these countries start to get more advanced mobile systems, cellular phone systems, this should continue to grow as well. So those are two companies that I currently own. I do have some other a couple of other companies that I think look attractive. I like in Indonesia, there's an automobile manufacturing company. They make heavy equipment and infrastructure. The name of the company is Astra International. Symbol is PTAIY. And the reason I like that is another one of the reasons that these countries, I think, are ripe for a lot of growth is their lack of advanced infrastructure and the need to grow more infrastructure. As we saw in China, all the buildings of roads and bridges and so forth, that's going to also take place in these other countries. So heavy equipment manufacturers might be a good place to be.
So if, as you said, infrastructure, banking, mobile phones, in essence, plays on rising consumer income, on the rising middle class, which in terms of the, apart from individual companies, are there any mutual funds in the U.S. that have a particular exposure? We were talking to a particular international body at Harding Loevner, which, of course, has a Frontier Emerging Markets Fund. But are there some other funds which have a specialization and which have done quite well?
There's a Wasatch Frontier Emerging Small Countries Fund, symbol is WAFMX, which has some a lot of holdings in a lot of these countries. They don't restrict themselves to these four countries that I mentioned, but they are heavily invested in Southeast Asia. If one wants to go with a very large fund company, Templeton Frontier, symbol TFMAX, these are open-ended funds. You mentioned the Harding Loevner. There are also some ETFs. If one wants to be a little bit more direct or focused on a particular country, there are ETFs for Turkey, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Philippines. And they tend to be iShares. There's also a Market Vectors Indonesia fund as well, and a Thailand fund. So there are a lot of different opportunities. If one wants to specialize in infrastructure, which I think is a very, very good theme, there's an iShares Emerging Market Infrastructure Fund, symbol EMIF. So those are just some ideas, and of course I would recommend to anybody considering these to do their own due diligence and take a look at the fund's past performance and costs as well.
Absolutely, Paul. And it goes without saying when talking about funds or ETFs to invest. But those are some very interesting ideas. We really appreciate you taking the time today to let us know your thinking and some of the things you like in these countries. And hopefully we'll be back to discuss how they've been performing in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you, Gavin.
Thanks, Paul. I think we might be sensible if we went to break now. And then we can hopefully have Samuel up and ready to talk to us by the time we back from break. Thanks very much indeed.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We were expecting to be speaking to our Africa correspondent, Samuel Okoja, from Lagos, Nigeria, but it seems that there are one or two issues with the phones in Nigeria, which seems to be a fairly constant theme when talking about telecommunications in sub-Saharan Africa, and indeed is one of the reasons why large numbers of people in Nigeria have several mobile phones, and the penetration rate is amongst the highest in the emerging markets because they're never certain whether or not they're going to have coverage. So you need to have different phones on different networks to make certain that you're able to actually be in contact at all times. In fact, it was one of BlackBerry's larger markets because they had the SMS system. So we're still trying to get back in touch with Samuel, but in the meantime, we also have another guest to talk about the recent election this weekend in Pakistan, where former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was returned to power after being in exile in Saudi Arabia for most of the last decade, since being removed by General Pervez Musharraf at the beginning of the 2000s. So we're hoping to have Wasim Khan from Silk Invest, which is a specialist frontier markets investing company, online fairly soon to us from London to look at what the results might mean as far as investors are concerned, as well as obviously the Pakistani citizenry. So just waiting to see if we have Wasim up and ready to talk to us, or whether or not we've had any success with getting hold of Samuel Okoja. But at present, we're still experiencing the delights of the difficulties in communications, which you sometimes get when speaking in frontier markets. So I'm just looking at the it seems as though we might have Wasim online with us at present. Hi, Wasim, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. The voice is not very clear, but I'm here. I can hear you barely, but I can.
Great stuff. Well, obviously we had the election in Pakistan this weekend, and Nawaz Sharif being returned to power. How has the Pakistani economy been doing over the last few years, and was there a reason why Sharif won as opposed to Imran Khan, whom a lot of people felt might be the winner in that contest?
I think what has happened here is that Nawaz Sharif has a majority, but not an absolute majority. So they picked up 46% in the National Assembly, where the total number of seats is 272. And Imran Khan's PTI has picked up about 10.7%. And the previous ruling party, the People's Party, 11.4%. Now, the question is if Nawaz Sharif will have to have a coalition. He needs some support for one of the parties. Either he will go to PP, the previous ruling party, which is the People's Party, or he'll go to PTI. Or he could, by the chance of him going to some of the other smaller ones, which have one or two or three seats, is limited. Nawaz Sharif, it seems to me, is a very positive thing that has happened for the political, social, and economic climate of Pakistan. And I would look at Nawaz Sharif being the prime minister, making the government in Pakistan, I would focus on like four different areas. It's a populist party, obviously, that in the votes they've received, 126 members elected in the National Assembly, which is 46%. They're pro-masses. They're pro-growth, pro-business party compared to the previous party, where a lot of the people that came into the government and in the party were people from different professions, some of them unknown. In Nawaz Sharif's government, in Nawaz Sharif's party, a lot of the people are very business-minded people. They are business people, and they want to see new policies that that will develop the business forward. The third issue is that Nawaz Sharif has very good relations with the Saudi hierarchy, which is a very big positive. And I think that, you know, that should improve relations between, economic relations between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which in essence is going to be more concessions on, or concessional oil that will flow to Pakistan, which Pakistan badly needs. The third thing is going to be that, Pakistan will have, and Nawaz Sharif will probably develop better relations with India. And I think that that's going to be very important also, because that will take the focus away from any confrontation policies more towards better improved bilateral economic relations between the two countries. And finally, I think that Nawaz Sharif's government will have better relations with the United States as well, which will pave the way for the U.S. In increasing its economic aid to Pakistan, followed by the IMF, which has a line of $5 billion lines, a credit line for Pakistan, which would be very useful for Pakistan to have in order to increase its FX reserves, which have been dwindling over the last year to year and a half, and also improve its balance payments position, which has been pretty precarious. So I think that based on those four points, I believe that the economic investment environment in Pakistan is very positive going forward. And I can go into detail.
So, I think it. No, that I think is an excellent summary of the positives that are likely to come out of Nawaz Sharif's party being a major player in whatever coalition is formed, and therefore hopefully an improved flow of funds into the economy. But obviously one of the attractions for investors looking at Pakistan is that there's it's a large populous country with a rapidly growing middle class. Would you agree that the domestic side of the economy is something that should be of interest to investors?
Definitely, it's going to be. It will be because, as you rightly mentioned, there's 200 million people growing at a rate of 3% per year. It's a big consumer society. So for FMCGs, i.e. fast-moving consumer goods, it's going to be a paradise. It's also going to be some of the industries that are likely to benefit from the Nawaz Sharif's government are, for example, cement, because Nawaz Sharif is going to put more money into infrastructure development, and construction will also pick up. It will also go into autos, which is associated with the population, of course. Fertilizers, which have suffered a lot in the previous years because of lack of natural gas. So when natural gas starts to flow into the new government, policies, I think that the fertilizers companies will be textiles, banks, all of these are going to be rising sectors in the economy.
So, given that
has been that Pakistan has suffered very significantly in the last couple of years from a huge deficit in its energy supply. And part of the reason for that has been that the previous governments have not been able to pay off the debt that they owe to the independent power producers. And Nawaz Sharif and his party have good relations with these IPPs, and I think that they would be able to pay off some of the debt in order to restore the supply of gas and electricity for both consumers and businesses.
Which will obviously help industrial production and growth. So just to finish up with, Wasim, what kind of time horizon do you see in terms of some of these opportunities coming to maturity? Are we talking in the next year or two, or perhaps somewhat longer term than that?
I believe that the next 5 years are very positive for Pakistan under this government, and I would say both the short and the medium term are extremely positive. I think that you will see rich economic growth somewhere in the region of 67% on average over the next 5 years. there will be more political and economic stability. I mean, that is what we expect. Depends who he's going to form a coalition with. If he does, with Imran Khan, and he has made that rapprochement with Imran Khan by visiting him in the hospital where Imran Khan is currently indisposed. I think that would be probably the best thing for Pakistan, because Imran Khan's party, while most of the people are inexperienced in politics, have a lot of integrity, and I believe that that would be very positive, joining in with Nawaz Sharif to form a new government. So the next item we look at very positively, and based upon the policies that this government will pursue and economic development that will take place, I think the longer term for Pakistan is also very positive. Again, 200 million plus people, growing at a rate of 3%, opportunities abound in almost every sector of the economy.
Excellent, Wasim. Well, thanks very much indeed, and sorry about the communication difficulties, but very glad to have you on. Our thanks to Wasim Khan in the London office of Silk Invest. And now we actually do have Samuel Okoja from Lagos, Nigeria on. Hi, Samuel, and sorry about the communication difficulties, but you're going to briefly tell us about a couple of major developed market companies which have exposure in Nigeria and Africa, I believe.
Absolutely, yes. Thank you very much, Samuel Okocha from Lagos. I want to start with Procter and Gamble. Well, P&G products remain popular in Africa. Well, P&G, of course, is actually a consumer product company. P&G products remain popular in Africa, especially here in Nigeria. And investments from the company continues to grow in the continent. The consumer giants have businesses in Nigeria, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and also plans to reach Angola and Ethiopia. It might interest you to know that recently the vice president of Procter and Gamble's global business unit, that's talking about Dimitri Panayotopoulos, visited South Africa, where he announced an investment of about $170 million to create a new manufacturing hub for its markets in southern and east Africa. So this P&G, of course, has its footprint on its continent, on this continent, and it's seeking ways to make sure it's expanded.
Okay, Samuel. And then lastly, in just a couple of minutes, Cadbury is also a company that's got a major exposure in Africa as well.
Yes, absolutely. Cadbury's penetration in Africa could be measured through its main markets here, which include Nigeria and Ghana in West Africa, South Africa and Namibia in the southern region, and Kenya in the east, while Egypt in northern Africa. They can see the spread east, north, west, and south. You know, in terms of performance, Cadbury Nigeria, for example, was one of the three Nigerian companies that topped the list of Africa's best performance stocks as of December 2012. Cadbury Nigeria is the market leader in sugar, confectionery, gum, and food beverages in Nigeria, with an overall market share of well over 50%. A similar situation runs in South Africa, where Cadbury's chocolate brand came tops in a brand survey in 2007 and 2009. So,
Samuel, thank you very much.
Remains strong.
That's great, Samuel, and really appreciate your taking the time to come through with that. I'm going to have to wrap up now, but we have another roster of informative guests lined up for you next week. I'll be talking to Patricia Wee from Morningstar, Paul Harris, the editor and publisher of the Columbia Gold Letter about the gold rush in Colombia, and Darren Viado, a retirement planning specialist in California, about how you can use emerging and frontier market funds in retirement. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Ahmed. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk and Role in an Investment Portfolio, scheduled for release by John Wiley & Sons in late summer this year, another book on frontier markets set for release before the end of the year. We're also the publishers of the FMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.